Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm your host, Paul David. I'm joined today by Simon Court, who's a leadership coach, founder of Value Partnership, and the author of the brilliant, I know this because I'm reading it, Founder's Legacy. Welcome to the show, Simon.
Thanks very much, Paul.
Yeah, good to have you on board. Just by way of introduction, we wanted to welcome Simon and mention that Value Partnership is a leadership consultancy firm. Do we have that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay. And Founder's Legacy out now, 50 game-changing leadership lessons for building a great business. I can vouch. I've been listening to it on my runs and my walks in Victoria Park. It's excellent.
Very happy to hear that.
Yeah. We'll be talking about that more today. And just to introduce Simon, after some time working as a management consultant at YSC and HR director at Ericsson, some of you might hear of that brand, Simon became a leadership coach and co-founded the Value Partnership with his wife Jane in 1998.
Don't forget her.
I won't forget Jane. How could I? And Simon's helped two tech companies grow into unicorns in the last 10 years, Miniclip and Tipico. So congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you.
As a leader of an agency that does growth consulting, growth management, we've helped take companies from unicorn to unicorn. So I can very much relate to that journey and understand what you've done there. So kudos.
Thank you.
Well, first things first, we want to just like kind of jump in and frame the work that you're doing. You work with founders, you work with leaders, and there's this sticky bit about how founders don't always think of themselves as leaders. And I want to dig in with you. Why do you think that is? And can you explain for our audience the difference between a typical founder and a corporate leader?
Sure. Let me try. And I guess your word typical is kind of important here because there's quite a wide variety of both.
Yeah.
Founders, you know, they are, you know, we see a lot of them in the public eye and especially tech founders. Mm. And I think what we see is not atypical of what I've experienced in less well-known businesses of various sort of shapes and sizes. The wonderful things about founders and the things that simultaneously can cause problems for founders too, especially a bit later on in their story, incredibly mission-driven. You know, they didn't become a founder to become a leader. The leadership bit is almost an accidental byproduct of creating a company and having that purpose that really compels them in the first instance to set up a business. Typically more creative than their corporate counterparts.
Yeah.
That's not to say corporate leaders can't be creative, but it's usually a more derivative form of creativity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more, I can make the connection between this, and I can see an opportunity here. Yeah. Rather than the raw creativity we often see from founders in building something from scratch. Because let's face it, that's what they're doing typically. Right. Founders are incredibly passionate. They're more likely to take risks versus their more cool-headed, a bit more risk-averse corporate counterparts. Mm-hmm. So we see some very different qualities. And we can back that up with a bit of evidence because I sort of quote this in the book. When we talk about the difference between leaders and founders, we use a tool called the GC Index, and we basically identify the majority of founders as game changers, something like two-thirds of them, very strong game changers. And that, what that means is they're both creative and a bit obsessive. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're a bit relentless in pursuit of what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's important because that gives them the kind of staying power and resilience to keep going.
Yeah.
Versus more corporate sort of managers who are typically strategists. In other words, they could be creative in the more derivative way that I describe, but, you know, they're more pragmatic. Mm-hmm. They'll just take sort of progressive steps to get where they want to go.
Yeah.
A bit more planful, a bit more organized.
I'm curious how we obviously spoke briefly about the two companies that you've taken to or helped, you know, guide to unicorn status. So like how that dichotomy between founders and leaders and yeah. sort of, you know, game changers versus strategists, how that played out at Miniclip and Tipico.
Yeah. Yeah, they're really interesting contrasts really. And they illustrate, I think, rather well that distinction that we've just been talking about. So take Miniclip. It's a classic founder story. Rob Small created Miniclip in his bedroom back at the beginning of this century. And he sort of had this quite strong vision to make gaming accessible to everybody. He sort of built up a lot of traffic to their website in the first decade of the company's existence. By the time he got to sort of 2011, 2012, I think I was introduced to him towards the end of 2012. The business was kind of flatlining mm-hmm. a bit. He kind of run out of energy, and he was reaching out for help at that time. Actually, it's a bit of a story about how we met, which is potentially a bit of a sidetrack, but I'll just tell you that his HR director, who knew me, bet a month's salary that if you met me, that we would end up working together. And I'm always grateful for her sort of courage in taking that call.
Expensive bets, man.
It was a bit of a high-risk move. I think she's since become a founder herself, well, which is perfectly illustrative of what we're talking about. Yeah. So I met Rob, and it became really clear that he'd built up a team based on people he knew and trusted rather than people who were maybe ideally suited to help him to build this business into the company it has now become.
That's a tough one, right? Because like I relate to this as a founder, like you start with the army you know, or the team that's around you, or your social network at the very least. So like how would you recommend founders to maybe broaden that, or to think about that differently, I guess?
Well, I mean, there's an awful lot I could say about that, but I think that the most important thing is to think about what it is you really need in order to build your company. Mm-hmm. And qualities like, do you trust them? Do you feel like you really know them? Mm-hmm. That's not the place to start. That's the place to arrive at once you've really understood what it is that you're going to need to build your business. And I think this is a perfect illustration of the problems that founders have quite early on mm-hmm. with embracing their role as a leader.
Yep.
Because if you don't think of yourself as a leader, you do think about people you know, people somebody will introduce you to.
Okay.
If you think of yourself as a leader, you stand back from the problem and you say, actually, what does this business need for it to grow and take off?
And that's quite a mature way of positioning yourself. Yeah,
it's
a
totally different way of thinking about the problem that is in front of you. And I think at that point, Rob quite quickly realized, I mean, he invited me to observe a meeting of his leadership group. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, he looked at me, I looked at him, I almost didn't need to say anything.
Wow.
And he just said, it's not going to work, is it?
Yeah.
I said, not really, not with this.
Based on what you saw from the leadership team in that
entirely,
moment.
Entirely, yeah. And, you know, it wasn't the only thing we did to assess, you know, where he was. But I think he quickly realized that the leadership team that had helped him to achieve amazing things with his business, because he had a lot of traffic to his website. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They had some iconic product, mm-hmm. things like Club Penguin, which were, every time I mention MiniClip to somebody today, they go, oh, I used to love Club Penguin, because it was like for youngsters, that was a growing up thing. Mm-hmm. But he realized he needed to change,
Yeah, and there's something to be said about the stages that a business is in, and like sort of, which is maybe a good introduction into the Tipico story, which is, you know, it sounds like an example of a group that took it as far as they could. We'd love to hear a bit more about that.
Yeah, so the Tipico founders, there were four of them. They built up their business in Germany. This is in the sports betting industry. It probably isn't very well known to UK or American listeners. And, you know, they had, there was the lawyer, the tech guy, the guy who understood the betting industry. They they had all of the specific competencies that they needed to understand how to tackle the marketplace, but they didn't really have the temperament or the interest in leadership and how to build the company. Mm-hmm. And their wisdom, I think, was they got to a certain point and they realized that their business is going to struggle unless they found somebody who would really embrace the CEO role. Mm-hmm. And that point takes us right back to Rob, actually. I said to him, you ready to step up and really lead this company? That's him embracing the leadership role. The typical story is where one of the founders recognizing that that's not them. Mm-hmm. It wasn't one of them, and it wasn't all of them.
Yeah.
They needed help. So they brought in a CEO from the outside, a guy called Jan Bolt. And I worked with Jan because I knew Jan from previous work together in Electronic Arts. And together we sort of set about finding the route forward for Tipico.
Yeah. And that's a hard thing to let go of your baby, you know, and step aside. I mean,
exactly. You know, like, we all use this terminology when we talk about our businesses. I do mine as well, even though I'm not CEO of it anymore.
Yeah.
And it's that attachment that is an extension of that obsession that we talked about earlier, which is what makes founders special in that they will go the extra mile to try to make this business successful. It's personal, right? And yet also that attachment can also lead to problems in stepping back, letting go, bringing in talented people, maybe more talented than you are, allowing them to make decisions, letting others fail, not just having everything on you. There's a whole bunch of things, I think, that come with that evolution of the business from startup mode into scale-up mode, which are quite difficult for a lot of founders. Not impossible, as Rob perfectly illustrates, but certainly difficult.
Well, I mean, we're nailing the segues today, by the way, Simon, so let's keep at it. Great segue into our next question about the founder's dilemma, which you write about extensively in your book. What is the founder's dilemma, and how can founders overcome it?
So another way of expressing the founder's dilemma is do you want to be rich or do you want to be king?
What if we want both, Simon?
Well, I think you can have both, and it's really up to you whether you're prepared to do the work to get both. But if we go back to the origin of the idea, it was a 2006 paper by a guy called Noam Wasserman, and it led to a book that he wrote in 2012 called Founder's Dilemma. And he basically, through research, showed that founder CEOs that let go of their business secured higher financial returns than founders who wanted to retain control.
But that letting go assumes that you've, as you said earlier, kind of stepped away from the challenges so that you're not micromanaging or dealing with them yourself, and then you've put the right people in the right seats at the right time in order to do that, right?
So his research was really identifying the inflection point where investors make it a condition of the level of investment you need for the founder CEO to step down.
Okay.
So a lot of this was about the business has reached a certain point. The outside investors are now in control of the company or in control of the board. And at that point, they're not convinced that the founder can continue to build and grow the business.
Yeah.
So a lot of founders lose control. Once they've lost control of the board,
yeah,
they've kind of lost control of their own destiny, really.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of founders listening can relate to that.
Yeah.
So governance and the nature of control is just as important to a lot of founders as their financial stake in the business. I think if a founder wants to continue to be CEO of their own company and get the level of outside investment and resources that they believe they need in order to scale up their business, they really need to step up. And if you're not prepared to step up as a founder leader, you should really step aside and get out of the way of the business that you want to succeed, the purpose that you believe in.
Can we dig into step up a little bit? I'd love to hear any concrete examples you have of leaders, founders, or whomever you're thinking of, how they've stepped up, like how they've, was it taking better care of themselves, exercise? Is it getting leadership coaching? Is it, how exactly would you ask these folks to step up specifically?
It's a very fair question. So if I just go back to Rob first, and then we sort of widen this out. Rob was, I think he realized he didn't really have, he wasn't in a position where he was being forced by an outside investor. He'd managed to build the company up without external investment to that point, which is pretty remarkable. At that point, he saw the opportunity to pivot into mobile, which was at that point, not today sadly, but at that point was just like a massive rocket booster for growth, of course, really. So that pivot and a clear strategic pivot was Rob learning to embrace a clear strategic direction for the company. And I think up to that point, he was in that mode of many founders, which is strategy is what corporate people do. We stay responsive. We respond to opportunities. We don't commit to future goals. And a lot of that, I fear, for founders is about avoiding the risk of committing to something and then failing.
Yeah, and not setting a clear vision.
Yeah, strategy. Exactly. Yeah. What happens if we don't achieve that? Well, you've just learned something, that's all.
Yeah.
So let's calm down.
Yeah.
Let's build a great team.
Yeah.
Let's come up with a strategy that addresses the decisive challenges we're facing in our business. And let's get the whole company, including our investors, if there are any, our customers, let's take everyone on this journey to build something really special.
Yeah.
And that's what Rob embraced. So stepping up as a leader means you've got to really embrace the role of the chief executive. Yep. And if you don't understand that role, and I think there's plenty of people out there, Ben Horowitz has sort of been known to talk about this quite a lot. He basically says, the thing that always seems to take investors by surprise for some reason, God knows why, because it's again and again obvious, is that founders don't know how to do the CEO job, typically. And so if you want to be in control of your company and become rich, you know, back to rich and king, you really have to embrace the job of the CEO and understand different dimensions of leadership. And in the book, I talk about four dimensions in one of the chapters there, that personal leadership, which is really all about, it leans into what you said about looking after yourself and recognizing that you can't lead well if you come from a place of being burned out and exhausted and don't understand your strengths and weaknesses and aren't prepared to get help and put personal growth front and center.
Yeah.
There's a whole piece about team leadership, surrounding yourself with exceptional people who have what it takes to build the business that you're trying to build. There's something about purpose leadership, making sure everybody is aligned with the purpose of the business and understands what that means for the practice of our work, the kind of clients we need, the way our products need to look and feel, the brand and what we stand for. And last but not least, the business leadership, the you know, having a coherent strategy, tracking performance, having some discipline around performance, and not being tolerant of poor standards because it's one of your mates. It's really important that, you know, that's that stepping into the role of a leader, really.
Yeah. I want to dig into the talent piece because that seems like, you know, it's one thing to sort of take care of yourself and to, you know, step up. That's been one of my biggest learnings as a founder and a CEO, is like coming to grips with, okay, I need to make sure I'm going to the gym. I need to make sure I'm in therapy. I need to make sure I'm in coaching. I need to think about my relationships, you know, with friends and with partners and how that connects to my job. That's been a massive area of growth for me. And then the business side too, I think every quarter seems like a different learning. Like this, you know, past few quarters has been finance, quarters before that it was HR and people. Now it's on to growth and sales. Like it's just been a, you know, incredible learning.
Yeah.
But the team bit, the people bit seems to be the most challenging. And I think maybe a lot of founders would agree with this. So, you know, finding the right talent is a phrase that gets thrown around a lot. And I think a lot of founders and leaders would say, that's really hard, Simon. How do I do that? And let's talk about specifics. So, you know, what steps can founders take to find the right team and what role can coaching play in that?
If you want to create a brilliant team, you first of all need to think about, what are we trying to do with this business? What is the plan? What is the strategy? And it comes back to that. If you don't have that piece, you can't really work on this piece well. And then consider, what are the key competencies, the key talents that you're going to need to surround yourself with? And you probably can't afford to get them all in one go. You know, nobody's ever in that privileged position of landing a brilliant team overnight. So you've got to take it step by step. I mean, in Rob's case, one of the first appointments he made was of a CFO who could elevate the grasp of the financial performance of the business and solve some very practical problems that the business was facing in the US market. And it accelerated his momentum on some really thorny issues at a remarkable pace. And I think it gave Rob the confidence that we need to keep going with this sort of talent building strategy. I think one of the weaknesses that some people have in this space is that we think of the team as we need a great CFO, we need a great CMO, we need a great CTO, we need a great HR lead, or whatever those pieces are for your business. And that tends to be how investors think about it as well.
Like we need superstars in each role.
Yeah, exactly. And what that misses is a really important ingredient, which is, how do we get the team to function as a team? And to do that, we really need to think about the essential disciplines of a great team. Because for me, the team is probably one of the most important organizational building blocks of great performance. And there are a number of essential disciplines we need for that to really work. That include a shared sense of purpose and clarity about what that actually looks like. We need shared strategy and performance goals, and they're all on the same page in terms of how we're going to execute on that.
Yep.
It means that we have complementary skills in the team. Mm-hmm. It means that we are mutually accountable, and we have such a strong sense of shared endeavor here that we will be entirely interdependent in the way that we function and work. So superstars don't work in that environment. And we also need some shared standards for how we work together. This is the kind of thing that a great sports coach would consider entirely obvious. But for some reason in the business world, we just don't invest enough time and energy in building great teams. So one of the things that I typically do with my clients is help them not only to make sure they've got the right people in place, but they also function really well as a leadership team.
What's an example do you have of like sort of a best practice of a leadership team that you'd encourage to ensure that they're working together collaboratively effectively? I'm trying to think of examples. Like one framework we're experimenting with or looking at jumping into is like the EOS, the entrepreneurial operating system, and you know they use this level 10 meeting structure that you have on a regular basis. And the meeting starts and ends on time, and we tackle issues, and we have an issues list, you know, like it's kind of like these practices, things like that. So yeah, if you can give us an example of, you know, kind of like a best practice or a tool that leadership teams, you know, you encourage them to use to speak to your point there.
Yeah. So again, I'd say it doesn't have to be one particular toolkit. I mean, I think there are so many, they're almost they're ubiquitous, right? And people get a bit obsessive about one or other. You know, OKRs are now sort of fairly common practice everywhere, thanks to Larry Page and Google. And I'm personally not too bothered. It sounds a bit non-committal, but I really think the most important thing is that a team figures out what its modus operandi is, how it's going to work together, and it agrees what those disciplines are.
Yep.
And they are committed to them.
Yep.
And they practice them. I mean, you sort of asked about learning, how do you learn to be a CEO? And I'm sure we'll get into that a bit more in a minute. But if you want to learn to be a great team, you need to practice. You need to practice teamwork. Practice is everything.
Yep.
And establishing those disciplines that I mentioned, such as strategy, key performance objectives, such as having standards for how we work together. It might be everyone turns up on time. It might be that we always have the conversation in the room, never outside the room. We straight with each other. I mean, teams are such an arena for personal conflict and difficulty, and it's almost a universal problem. Yep. And the standards in business in general are so poor, in my experience, that the teams that win are the ones that really invest in their practices and then in their disciplines. And the human dimension of that is probably the most important of all. Some of your listeners might know of a wonderful little book by Patrick Lencioni called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, which I prefer to think of as the sort of five functions of a team, where basically we talk about trust as the foundation stone, which starts with a bit of vulnerability. And that vulnerability means I can say to you, you know what, Paul, I'm not entirely comfortable with what we're doing here. I need a bit of help. And and it comes back with you saying, how can I help? And I have now demonstrated that I trust you with my insecurity, my feeling of vulnerability, and you have demonstrated that you're trustworthy because your response has not been to tell me that I'm losing confidence in you. It's been to say, I want to help you. So that level of vulnerability, which is a kind of an essential for all leaders, leads to us being able to have difficult conversations when we need to, which leads to us making better decisions, which leads to us making commitment to those decisions rather than just being half-hearted about them. And if we do that, you know what? We'll be a great team. So establishing those disciplines, talking about how we're doing regularly, and making sure that you don't tolerate poor standards around them. You call it out. You just don't accept poor standards. Those are some of the things that I think people who are not experienced leaders can sometimes find hard. Because it means having more difficult conversations than they might be used to.
I mean, to that point, we've talked a lot about great leaders and you know, where they get their training. And I know one thing we talked about pre-show is just like, where are these folks getting that training? Like where, and I know one of your goals is to kind of like, you know, share your learnings and help scale those learnings, which is a great, you know, great reason to produce the book. So I guess getting to this question of like how and where, other than just practice itself inside these startups, these organizations, are great leaders formed? How do we scale these learnings as you're trying to do with your book, you know, to leaders of all kinds across business, tech, politics, to kind of get leadership to where it needs to be?
Yeah. That's a great question as well. And I think, you know, the foundation stone for learning is a growth mindset. I am not fixed.
Absolutely.
I believe that I can grow and I can learn. And, you know, both of the leaders that I worked with to build Unicorns were entirely growth oriented, which made my job simple, really. Practice is everything. It's interesting, a piece of work by a guy called Ali Tamaseb, who wrote he analyzed unicorns over a quite lengthy period, about 15 years. And the thing that he identified was that there was nothing. It wasn't age. It wasn't education. Mm. There was no pattern in who was successful, except that they'd done it before. They tried before.
So is that to say that almost in one way, like failure is the key ingredient to success?
Well,
or having tried, perhaps?
No. I think failure was a good ingredient, and success was a good ingredient as well. I mean, I think some of them had successful startups, but sort of maxed out. They decided to sell or whatever they decided. Some of them were flops. It didn't seem to matter.
Yeah.
I mean, it mattered marginally that successful founders became more successful founders, but I mean, unsuccessful founders were still more likely to succeed second or third time around than the others. So as a practice does help enormously in it, learning from your experience. So the great thing about a coach is, I think there's a couple of things. One is you get a chance to reflect on and learn from your experience rather than simply move on and try and bury that slightly catastrophic interaction you had or that bad day at the office. You really take stock of what came out of that for you and what have you learned and how can you improve. It's also a safe space to talk about all your uncertainties and your sort of frailties, because if you're honest, I mean, I suspect, you know, I haven't really heard him talking in a very vulnerable way, but even the Elon Musks of this world must have dark, dark days about.
I'm sure he does.
He seems a rather dark person. So, so it's a really important thing. And I think coaching, it doesn't have to be a coach. It can be a mentor. It can be somebody you're close to who's really good at holding up a mirror and really good at listening and helping you to make sense of your experience. So that comes with a growth mindset. If you don't have that growth mindset, you won't get a coach, and you probably won't buy a book like mine and think, you know, what can I get from this? You just think you're good already. Ego is the biggest barrier to learning, frankly.
Ego is the enemy. That's ego a great is book definitely by enemy, Ryan Holiday. And fun fact, our coach that we work with, a man by the name of James Johnson, is coming out with a piece literally called How I'd Coach Elon Musk, and kind of, you know, which I think is fascinating.
He's a brave man.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's like to very much to the point of sort of like, you know, we look at these big leaders and they surely must have their challenges and their dark days, as you said. So how do we look at what they're facing and have it inform, you know, how we coach ourselves or our coach? And kind of how we think of our own journeys, you know, I think that's really important.
So there's three things that I tend to look for in a coachee to enable them to achieve a breakthrough. I mean, first is, do they really see themselves accurately? And there's all sorts of ways of building self-insight, including using behavioral tools, psychometric tools, but feedback, journaling, there's observation. There's lots of ways of building up a picture of yourself. So somebody who's got a growth mindset will want to know what they are actually like in practice. And somebody observing you in practice, like I had the opportunity to do with the leaders I've worked with, can give you quite a good readout on how you're doing. So if you see yourself accurate, then you can recognize where your strengths lie. You can build on those, and you can also recognize behaviors that are a bit more problematic and are a bit overused, perhaps. And then secondly, we need to understand their level of motivation to change. Rob was totally committed to becoming a great CEO and was ready to do the work. If you're not motivated, you're never going to make that leap. And then the third piece is, how do I do it differently? What's a better way? So you need, and that's where coaches and others can provide tools, different strategies, especially around management issues you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. how a lot of founders seem to struggle with that.
Yeah.
I probably spend maybe half of my coaching with clients working on, you know, how am I going to deal with this very difficult conversation I've got coming up with my CTO, or how do I handle this major disagreement I've got in the team around strategy so we get to a good outcome.
Yeah. Just people issues. Just sort of.
It's not like behavioral issues, because it's one of the least sort of comprehensible things to somebody who's maybe got an amazing technology background or, you know, a brilliant marketer, but finds people a bit harder to grapple with.
Or they haven't been taught, you know, to sort of have a certain level of empathy or exercise in a specific way, or even trained, you know, on these different conversations that to have. To that point, you know, about training, we're a tech podcast, so we'd be, you know, a bit remiss if we didn't ask it, you know, sort of tech questions. But we spoke about this a little bit, like potential applications for tech. And obviously some of this is just good old fashioned, let's just sit down and coach and be coached and things like that. But curious your thoughts about how, you know, different things like AR, VR, AI and all the various acronyms could be used in coaching. And
since we chatted about this, I've actually been thinking about this some more, and because it's not, you know, I confess to anybody who's not watching this, who's listening, I'm 63 years old, so I'm not fretting about the future of, I actually am fretting a bit about AI, to be honest, but I'm not thinking about it as much as probably you are and a lot of people are right now. But there's a young man who I've helped a bit who's founder and CEO of a company called Limbic AI. And Limbic have built a mental health chatbot tool. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting, very exciting what they're doing, because, you know, there is quite a big shortage of therapists, and there is an epidemic in mental health problems in the UK, and not just in the UK, I'm sure. And they have found a way of making the kind of help that a lot of people need more accessible and more scalable. It's quite remarkable what they're doing. I'm really impressed with it. And I'm sort of pivoting from there back to the leadership question. I mean, looking into AI, do you know what generative AI is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I've just been learning about that. Yeah. And it's sort of kind of creative AI, really, right? And I think that holds some really interesting potential for personalized leadership coaching for people, maybe more scaled leadership coaching for people as well. So people can create situations that are realistic and really helpful for people to practice without significant cost. You don't need a reassuringly expensive coach to coach you. You can actually work with a more remote model and find ways of really improving your practice without huge effort and cost.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of like simulations, you know, putting people into a boardroom or, you know, that difficult one-on-one meeting with a team member or something like that. I think there's a lot of potential there. And I like the idea of like, you know, having almost like a chat bot or a voice assistant that's trained in the Patrick Lencioni and Simon Court books on leadership, right? That can, you know what I mean? Now I'm putting a lot of coaches out of business here potentially, but that's attractive in terms of what we discussed before, like scaling those leadership learnings. And there's still going to be a role for coaches, obviously, folks like yourself who have, you know, led businesses to become unicorns or you know, themselves were CEOs. But if we can scale those leadership learnings a bit more through some of these tools, I think that's really exciting for leadership, you know, in many ways.
I think it absolutely is. And I actually, when I was writing the book, somebody introduced me to ChatGPT. So I took the plunge and I said, okay, write me a chapter in the style of a leadership coach about, you know, one of the topics of the book. And I said, you know, you've got a budget of 1,000 words. And I'm looking for some great questions for a founder. And the first time I read it, I thought, oh my God, why have I put all this effort in this bloody thing?
It did a good enough job. Like, you were impressed.
Initially it was. And then I read it again. And then I thought, no.
Yeah.
And the no was, it clearly had no empathy for the topic at all.
Yeah.
It was sort of tangibly lacking in any kind of visceral feel for the topic.
Okay.
So it was absorbing and reporting.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got to be honest, I thought it was sort of a brilliant effort.
Yeah. Sure.
But I downgraded my A to a sort of B minus by the time I finished. But I could see the potential of it. And I don't think it'll be very long. I think Elon has already said that by next year or something, it'll be as bright as an individual human. But you won't carry into the room. Don't say this for my own ego, but just, if you have somebody like me who's been coaching for 25 years, you don't have that, you know, and you don't have that human connection. Yeah. Yeah. I think Rob and I have a very special relationship. Jan and I have a very special relationship, having worked together for so long. And I think there's something about going on a journey with real people and looking after each other a bit along that journey, if you see what I mean. There's something.
I think the thing that I like, you know, I hesitate to say it will never be as good as, but like, I think that like, if there's, I have to believe on some level, and this, this, I'm sure this is going to be thrown back in my face when this technology surpasses us, but like, you know, there's some intangible thing about the fact that you have spent the past 25 years with founders like Rob and what you get from that, that is difficult, if not impossible, to replicate or even simulate. And in the same way that there's many things that, you know, the AI can do that we can't do, I think maybe the reverse has to be true and maybe will be true for a while, if not forever, remain true. So, you know, just those bits of like, oh, I was in the room when Rob said this or when this other founder did that, and here's my learning from it. AI is not in the room for that, you know, and I feel like it'll be, unless it completely downloads your brain, Simon, and is able to regurgitate that, which could possibly happen. Let's
My body will fail within the next 20 years, so you can have the brain. But it's like there's a Eli Bressett, one of the people I talked to for the book. He's built a travel tech business, luxury travel, and they use AI and machine learning to make their business more efficient. And it's really, I found it really interesting. I think he calls it human in the loop systems. So it's the partnership between AI and humans that I think we're probably heading towards at its best. Where, you know, you can save a lot of time and energy on some of the more productivity driven aspects of learning. And you can get that human touch in partnership with it where it really counts rather than for everything.
Want to talk about the book a little bit, more, and kind of, you know, you mentioned that one of your goals is to teach more and help people beyond your coaching, which I think is brilliant. And as far as I'm concerned, mission accomplished, because you're sitting with at least one founder who's already gotten a lot from the book. And in many ways, like, it's happened at the right time for us, because I feel like we're at a point where we're reaching kind of stage two of the company, where I need to sort of, I think my biggest learning from my coaching last year with James was, you know, I need to really step into my power and as CEO. And I think you sort of mentioned that that was
good for you. That's brilliant.
It's not easy,
it isn't. I said, but you're kind of working on the business rather than in it. That's a really big deal.
It's hard. Let me put it that way. But I just think that was like a confronting and a very helpful way moment for me. You know, I'm reminded of the Stevie Nicks line in Gypsy, like, it all comes down to you. You know what I mean? And like, that's what I felt at the end of the year. And stepping into your power sometimes means, you know, those difficult conversations ramp up, and the heaviness, you know, it doesn't get any lighter. In fact, it gets heavier, and the decisions you have to make get even tougher. And so I just really appreciate all the points in the book that I've, you know, really enjoyed, where you call that out and you give stories about individuals who have made it through that, you know, because it gives me a little, oh, there's some light at the end of the tunnel.
You are not alone. Definitely not alone.
I felt that. But I mean, the book was published in March. I'd be curious to hear, you know, how it's been received so far, and kind of what your hopes are for Founders Legacy as it moves forward.
Yeah, so I suppose why did I write it? I basically wanted to make this sort of experience accessible to a much wider audience, and, you know, at a very good price, hopefully. And I think what founders do matters. I think it matters socially. It matters economically. Yeah. I think founders are essentially brave people. I admire them for that. And I took a lot of courage for me to create a business, and I never regretted it for one moment. And it's come to one of the defining stories of your life, really. Essentially, you can live through your own values and follow your mission and your purpose. I realized quite early mine was to help others to achieve their purpose, and that was my purpose. And I felt completely settled once I realized that. Mm-hmm. And so this book is sort of a natural extension of that. And I have to say, a lot of your younger listeners won't get this perhaps yet, but you reach a certain point in your life and you just think, I have to give this away now. It's the most valuable thing I have and I have to give it away. Mm. And so writing the book was like a conversation with myself about, mm-hmm. okay, so what have I learned? Mm-hmm. What do I need to say mm-hmm. to the world? And so because I care about founders and because I wanted to unpack my experience, it's, I hope it comes across with empathy and a sort of bit of love, if you like.
Yeah.
Because actually it's a big deal what people are wrestling with.
Yeah.
A lot of people who don't understand it will sort of go, why are you getting so emotional about a book about leadership? But actually I think it's deeply human.
It is.
And it is a really, and I've had some lovely feedback. I don't know how the sales are going. I genuinely don't know.
What's some of the feedback you've gotten?
But I mean, share. Some of the feedback is, on one hand, there's feedback that says, I love the fact that I can access these incredibly practical, helpful chapters around, you know, around hiring. I can literally go straight to the chapter on hiring and as I approach a hiring problem and think about, okay, what have I got from Simon to help me think about this problem in a sort of more elevated way or in a better way. But also some feedback around the whole, I think somebody used the term, the whole arc of the book gives me a sense of the humanity that's required to lead well.
Yeah.
And the values that make for exceptional leadership.
Yeah.
Because I really want to counter this sort of idea that seems to be in a popular myth when you observe people like Elon, and I don't want to pick on him, but... I'm
sure, time you're mentioning
I'm sure
time.
He can take care of himself. This is the second time. Yeah. I'm clearly obsessed with him. But I mean, he doesn't represent the potential for what great leadership can look like. Founders do not have to be like that. We can admire his incredible purpose and conviction without wanting to lead like that.
Yeah.
So I think there's something about leading well and doing the right thing and being a decent person. Because I guarantee your legacy at the end of this... It won't just be your business and whether it was successful or not. It will be that feeling you get when you look in the mirror and you're shaving or you're putting your makeup on or whatever your thing is in the morning. And do you feel like you've honored your values? Do you feel like you have lived a good life and looked after people along that journey and tried to do the right thing? Those are the things that you'll carry with you to the end of your life.
That's the thing that struck me about reading the book was exactly what you're saying, is that like how human it is and was, and how so much of what you talk about touches on like individual decisions that we make as leaders and how we're going to treat ourselves, how we're going to treat other people, how we're going to get other people working together collaboratively and kindly. And I feel like that it's so easy to be cynical, I think, about leaders, especially in business and found, oh, these are just some rich jerks who just, you know, they started their business and they just, you know, they fired a bunch of people and blah, blah, blah. Like, but when you really dig into it, it really comes down to that individual, that founder, that leader, you know, treating themselves well, treating their teams well, and trying to build something larger than themselves with that as the basis. And that's what I found really powerful about it.
I'm absolutely thrilled with that. One piece of feedback that means more to me than somebody telling me that I've sold 1,000 books or whatever it is.
Absolutely.
It's so much more important. And, you know, in the end, it's very, I should just say, I mean, I dedicated this book to my daughter. She's 28. Yeah. She's
it's Megan, yeah?
Yeah, it's Megan. Yeah. Thanks. We get her name on the podcast. She's absolutely a super smart, talented young woman, and I think she's got enormous leadership potential. No pressure, Megan. Sorry for saying this. It's not that I'm at all biased, but I kind of this is my legacy for her in a way. And I find that a kind of touching thought that she'll have the Spotify version. If I had my dad talking to me from when he was in his prime, it would be gold for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just love that.
Yeah.
So I hope that will always be there for her.
I relate to that a lot as well, Simon, because I grew up with two parents who were both small business owners, and I got to watch them both lead their own small businesses and actually work together. And it took me a while to kind of, I think I was, you know, in my early 30s by the time I started my own business, but I really grounded myself in, okay, what did you learn from them? And what did you, and I started to pull out the bits of the beautiful lessons that I kind of implicitly and sometimes explicitly learn from them about how to run, how and why to run a business, and to how to treat people, how to employ people, everything from, you know, small things like we ran a corner store and my dad would give the rubbish men who came by every Monday, he'd give them water on hot days and sodas and things like that. And he never really said why, but it dawned on me later on that we were a store and we produced extra rubbish. And these guys had to spend a little more time out in front of our store on Mondays. Nice. And so these people weren't really his employees, but they were his stakeholders. Yeah. And he was taking extra care of them so that, you know, the rubbish got taken away and that they wouldn't be pissed if we had a little bit extra, you know, wooden bits or something like that. And it slowly started to dawn on me that these were lessons that I was being taught and that I was absorbing, but I hadn't. And so now I think about that in terms of, you know, do we send a little thank you gift to the person who gives us a referral for business? Like, absolutely. Yeah. You know, like little things like
that. Isn't that nice? Those sort of early experiences in your life clearly carry over into the way you think about the way you live your values today and the way you try and treat people.
That's right.
I mean, I think you're doing just fine, but I, you know, and we all have bad days, so don't beat yourself up when you don't get it right. My dad was a headmaster, and he was an orphan, and I never discovered that until he was in his 20s.
So was my dad.
Is that right? Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So I feel I want to champion people who don't have all the breaks.
Yeah, right. God, and yeah.
So this sort of idea about leadership being about, you know, it's just about who's prepared to put in the work and it's got the raw talent.
Yeah.
Things like degrees and all of that, somehow it gets in the way of us identifying real talent. My dad's trick was that as a headmaster, he had a school of 900,000 children.
Wow.
And he knew every child by name.
Yeah. Wow.
I was like, I said to him, when I was old enough to kind of clock this, I said, how do you do that?
Yeah.
And he said, very deliberately.
Yeah.
And I said, well, but sorry, how do you do that? And he said, I teach all the first years when they come into the school.
Yeah.
I teach them all math. So I keep my eye in with teaching.
Yeah.
And if I teach all the first years, after that, I'll know all their names.
Yeah,
you've connected. And so, by the time he'd gone through six years or whatever it was, he knew them all.
Yeah.
And he carried on doing that for his whole time as a headmaster. So we all have these tricks, but it starts with saying their individual names matter.
Yep.
It's not about 1,000 children.
Yep.
It's not about selling 1,000 books. It is about every individual person, every transaction, every conversation you have, and hopefully leaving that person somehow better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an Einstein quote in a book, probably my favorite quote in the book, because there's lots of quotes in the book you probably discover. He basically said, strive not to be a success, strive to be of value.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's actually much wiser than it looks at first glance, the more you think about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're trying to do here, right?
Yeah. Is that where you got the name Value Partnership? Is that what's...
A little bit. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things about that name, but striving to be a value is certainly part of it.
Yeah. I think that too is like, and I think that's maybe a good place to close, but that's what we're trying to deliver to, you know, our clients. You know, we're trying to, you know, show them that we are of value and that we are, you know, the partnership is something that they should value because we're sort of mutually sharing value. You know, I try to think about that with our team, like what are our values and how we're living them as a team. I think it's such a cross-cutting word, you know, like in terms of how you live them, how you deliver it, you know, like value is just... it's just, I think, the core of business, you know, like really. So
it is absolutely the core of business. Yeah. And having values for how you deliver that value is how people see your humanity, I think. Mm-hmm. As would be generous, clear-sighted, and a true partner.
Mm.
Generous in the human sense of the spirit of it. Clear-sighted means you can cut through, you can see the truth honestly.
Yep.
And being a true partner means challenging, not just supporting.
Mm-hmm.
Rob and I didn't have a good relationship because I was only supportive with him.
Yep.
I'd be quite tough with him sometimes.
Yep.
And what do we call that? Tough love, I think, really. Yeah. You know, because it comes with care.
Yeah.
If you care, you'll do good work.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, especially in coaching too, I always appreciate it when my coaches they're a bit tough on me because I know it's grounded in that trust and that love that we have for each other and that it's coming from a place where they want me to succeed, you know? So, And I feel like I need that. I respond to that style of coaching. So that helps me. Not everyone does.
Good to know. Yeah, no, you're right. Coaching is a very personal thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I shared with you before, I'm on a journey myself to become a coach. And it's really confronting and challenging in a lot of good ways, because it's unveiling for me the ways in which I've been conditioned myself to lead, and how I can vary those and change those. And I know leadership and coaching are very different, but there's a lot of crossover, obviously. So
I think leaders who are good coaches generally make better leaders.
Yeah,
I think there's a really, it's a really important strategy. Yeah. And one of the issues I sometimes have with there's been a huge growth in training in coaching.
Yeah.
And it's very process driven. I think it needs to be values driven.
Yeah.
And so I sometimes feel that, when somebody is struggling, sticking to your process is not good enough.
Yeah.
So I think that's where our humanity should cut in, and we should be prepared to change the way we work.
Yeah.
And it always, for me, starts with client, and it starts with what's the real issue, the presenting challenge here, rather than this is how I coach.
Yeah. And structures and processes and sequences. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We just finished our second week in the training that I'm in, and it was very, very framework and process heavy. And I sort of found myself asking, like, where am I in this? Where's my style? Where are my values in this? And it was,
A very wise American consultant once said to me, bring who you are to what you do, Simon. Yeah. And because I had gone off piste completely in a training program, and everyone else gave me feedback and said, you shouldn't have done that. You should have stuck with your process. And he disagreed. He said, why did you do that, Simon? And I said, it felt right, and I think he needed something different from me.
Yeah.
And he said, stick with what you feel in that moment, because actually what you did felt right to me too.
Yeah.
And I think that's the art, not the science.
Yeah.
And I think we all have to learn to trust when we should leave behind the process and focus on the outcome and focus on the human being at the heart of.
Well, that's a great place to end on. This has been a fantastic episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. We talked today with Simon Court, who's a leadership coach, founder of Value Partnership, and the author of Founders Legacy, about coaching tech startup founders in today's environment. Really grateful for your time today, Simon. Thanks so much.
It's been a lot of fun.
How do folks, if you can, where do they find you and Founders Legacy on the interwebs? Where can they find out more?
So you'll find about us at value-partnership.com, and you'll find the book on Amazon, all the usual websites. It's also on Spotify, and there's an Audible version that Amazon will eventually get out there onto the web as well. So there's just Google Founders Legacy, you'll find us.
Yeah, it's Founders Legacy, 50 game-changing leadership lessons for building a great business. I highly, highly recommend it. I highly recommend the Spotify or audiobook version. You can have Simon's very own dulcet tones streaming into your ears all day, as I do as I'm on my walks and runs. And it does add, I think, a human element to it. And you can really hear the stories of the amazing work Simon's done to coach multiple founders to unicorn status in the tech world. I just can't recommend it enough. So thanks for taking the time today, Simon.
It was a pleasure. Thanks a lot, Paul.
Awesome.